Jerry Farmer, Real 4. You'd reached TAC HQ.
They took us back to TAC HQ, and Captain Scott, the medical officer, he came out to deal with us. The three boys in the back were okay. I was okay, but the corporal beside me, he had a split head from his temple to his temple, completely split, pouring the blood, and we assumed that the bar of the jeep that holds the camber screws on had cut his head. That's what we assumed. Because it looked like it was a complete bar across the air. He was in a panic stricken way, he was in the blood, I think, which proves we wasn't really soldiers. He was panicking. And Captain Scott came out and he was going to deal with us when suddenly, I can't say it was a bell, but I had an impression of a bell ringing. And he said, clear the MI room, we've got wounded coming in, the patrol's been shot up. So he cleared us all out. Well, the corporal never fainted, but he almost passed out, he just collapsed. So two of us helped him up. You know, it's laughable now, but we held him up and we all went off to various where we went. He stayed in the MI room waiting for the wounded to come in. I went back to bed. I was in bed for a good, I would say, hour, deep sleep. Someone wake me up again. Get over to Captain French, wants to see you immediately. I was still in my wet clothes, I hadn't changed. So in the middle of the night, soaking wet, I stood in front of Captain French. And did I get a dressing down from him? He wants to know where the jeep is. And I said, it's underwater somewhere. So he said, underwater, my jeep? And I said, I can't even say where it is. So he went mad. So he said, I'm not telling you for what you've done. You've done one thing wrong. Losing the jeep, leaving the jeep. He said, losing the jeep as an accident or under fire, but you left that jeep. You've left it. He said, I can't believe you've left it. He kept saying, my jeep. I can't believe you've left it. So I said, right, you stay where you are. He went and got a really recovery, and I'm with two people, a sergeant and someone else, really made my life hell, moaning at me, because it's dragged them out in the middle of the night, and I can't find the place. And we're up and down this road, and they're saying, they're going mad. And I said, how can I tell you? It all looks the same to me. Anyway, we didn't find it. So we went back, and they did find it next day, and it was all smashed up, terribly smashed. You should see it. You know, all the roof caved in, all these bars caved in at the top. So anyway, he chucked me off the, threw me off the SDS, I believe, because I had to go on company orders to Captain Barter. I thought, well, here it comes now, back to rifle company. And would you believe what job I got? The CO's driver. And all the boys were saying to me, do they not want, they want to get rid of the CO after that? Because the last person to choose would have been what I just did. But they did. And I didn't fancy the CO's driver. Captain Barter said to me, I've got nobody else I can put on it. And I said, and I mentioned lots of my friends' names. How can they be CO's driver? So then I assumed it was because the type of person I was, not rather what driver I was, because you don't only have to be a decent driver to drive a CO, you have to have some tact. And I suppose it comes over your personality. I mean, we had some rough drivers who never really respected officers, really regretted calling them sir. But I always did the right thing, and I did really have an ability to tell them what they wanted to hear rather than telling lies. You know, I would tell them, I would know it would please them what they wanted to hear, you know, and show willingness. So I believe that's the reason I got to show a driver. Well, of course, that's another volunteer. So I thought to myself, well, plum job. Corporal Jordan had got malaria and he'd gone to Kure in Japan. And everyone was saying, oh, are you lucky? All that food you're going to get. And, you know, when he drops you off somewhere, I became CO's driver in the middle of May, I became CO's driver, Colonel Stevens. Really, I've never had any dealings with him. And the very first morning, I arrived to pick him up to the. Actually, it was actually more dangerous being CO's driver, because what people didn't realise was he had to do the rounds of every company in the morning. So where you was in A company, and you was dug in, perhaps a little way behind the line, and there was no action, you was up the front every morning. Every single morning you was up the front line with a jeep. Yeah? And he insisted, which I can't see reason why the mentality of a people with brains like an officer, a colonel, he's sitting over having a 9-foot-high fusilier brass badge on the front of his Jeep, which I had to keep covered over when he wasn't in it, and undo it when he was in it. And that glinting sunlight and observation post from the hills and the CO, you know you're going to get it, because we used to broadcast saying, "We see Colonel Stevens yesterday." You know, they used to broadcast over town, boys. They used to say, "I see the CO's been up the front line of A Company again yesterday." So I knew they knew where we was. So I was beginning to get a bit afraid then. And it got us in the end, really, because I threw a couple of incidents that happened with the Colonel. We were driving along one day. He said, "Have you heard of a hill in Korea called 355? It was the tallest hill in Korea. The Dunn Light Infantry was on it at this particular time. The same brigade as we was in. Colonel Stevens had to go to visit. He used to do the rounds. Not only did he do the rounds of our companies, but he did the rounds of other forward areas to meet their colonels, which made it even more dangerous, you see. But people wouldn't have it. All my friends saying, "Ah, lovely, it's a lovely job, you know." He said, "I've got to see, go to 355. Well, if you know much about the Korean War, 355, the only way to get up on 355 was a big long trek, and it was known as the Bowling Alley. And the Bowling Alley was because the Chinese would lob mortar. There was very good mortar men, Chinese, whatever else they was, fighters, they were good mortar men. They could put a mortar down the hatch of a tank when it opened, which they did several times. When the Americans used to have static tanks, they never used tanks, but they were static. And when they used to open the turrets, they could put a mortar down a turret. That's what we was told. They were good. And most of our casualties were mortars. Most of our casualties were mortars. I was going to take him up this bowling alley. Never been up there before. So the boys were saying to me, "Well, it was terrible up there. You know, you're mortaring all the time. You're lucky to survive this." So I was tense. And we get they had a barrier, and they had a trench at the side, a dugout, where the people who manned the barrier was down there. And it used to be manned by different armies, Turkish. Yeah, I've met all sorts of people, Turks and Americans and natives, all sorts, you know. And this particular day, it was the Americans. And it was a rather humorous story come out of this, because we pulled up with the barrier manned, and two Americans kind of came out, leaned on the Jeep like this, you know, they slovenly. They had yellow scarves, I can see it now, chromium helmets, and they're in the front line, and they were military policemen. And one, I think, was a corporal or something, because he had upside down things here. Leaned on the Jeep like this, and they said, "Hey, buddy, you can't go up there. It's under heavy fire. We've lost two vehicles already." So the colonel's sitting there holding the strap of the Jeep, you know, on this side, he's their side, just sitting there. Never looked at them, Colonel Stevens. And they're leaning, talking to him, but he's not looking at them. So he said to me, he turned away from me to me, he said, "Will you tell them who I am?" So I said, "You are speaking to the commanding officer of the 1st Battalion, the Royal Fusiliers." Well, they jumped to attention. They saluted. They went over to a phone, and this is his actual words, what he said. "We have got some sort of royal guy here." He said, "What do we do?" So there was a long pause, and he said, "Sir," he said, "you can go through, but I've been told to say you do it at your own peril, and there was no responsibility on us." And he never even answered me. He said to me, "Drive on." And we drove up there, and do you know what? There wasn't a shot fired or anything. It was a lovely day, birds whistling. It was lovely, yeah? And I always look back on that. They thought it had royalty up the front line, which I don't think would happen. Well, they did with Andrew, I suppose. The other thing was that I would like to point out was Colonel Stevens was a father figure. The rumour was going around that he would not want to lose National Servicemen. He used to... We heard, this is only a rumour, but we heard that there was some sort of... something going on with him in the War Office, because he wouldn't commit himself to the war like he should have done, you know, and that was a kind of a rumour, you know, and he used to say, "No, they're all young boys, all young servicemen." So he was like a father figure, and he had an officer, a Lieutenant Dreisler, who was heir to a whiskey fortune, and my officer, which was, this was before I went driving, which was Lieutenant Hoskins, he came from a very rich, posh family, Lord Lady Hoskins, who King's counsellor, and he said, At a meeting, Lieutenant Twistow wants to charge up this hill. He says, we need the hill to annihilate the challenge. So he said to us, don't ever get in Lieutenant Twistow's platoon. So he said, oh, it was funny today. He said, Lieutenant Twistow said, can we charge the hill, sir? And Colonel Stevens said, I think not, Mr. Twistow. He said, we think we'll leave it to the professionals. So anyway, that was that, you know. So he turned out to be a nice, fatherly figure. When I first picked him up the very first morning, it was a foggy morning. I used to have to pick him up at 5:10. I used to be there at 5:00, wait for him to come out of the bunker. He got in the Jeep, and he had a... Colonel Stevens, as you can see by his photograph, always had a mouth that looked like he was smiling, a permanent grin. So, taking him to be friendly, I said, good morning, sir. He never answered. So we drove along, went up there. Right? So he said, Farmer, we'll get this straight before we start. You speak to me when I speak to you. And no other time. Sorry, sir, I said. I'll do that, right? And that's all he said to me. And from then on, it was morning, Farmer. I thought, what have I done? I've got a miserable bloke here. What have I done, you know? I've got him moaning at me and at the front line every morning. Do you know what? He was like my dad. That man was like my dad. He used to take me to some camp to visit, and he said to me, go and get yourself a meal. And I used to say, they don't like it. So I said, I'll get down there and they moan. They look good sergeants when they've cleared away. They don't want to get rid of food. And they hate giving their food away. It's like they own it. So I said to him, tell him I said so. So I go down there, I say, Colonel Stevens sent me down for a meal. Meal? You're not hungry, surely. I said, yeah, I'm not hungry. So, they moan when they get their food out. They dare not say no. So I got round to actually going and getting meals because they couldn't question him. Although he hadn't said get a meal, I was going and eating all around the place because they dare not go and say to the CIO, did you tell him to come for a meal? He'd go mad. He said, well, he can have a meal if he wants one. You know, so I was on a good thing there, actually on a good thing. So I rather enjoyed being with him, but I knew it was dangerous. It's almost coming to an end, really, because that was in May. The history is that the Duke of Wellington Regiment, you know, the Duke of Wellington was on the hook. Well, the hook was dreadful. If you was going to get it, you'd get it on the hook, because the hook jutted out like what it said it was, the hook. I think they had one called Sausage Green Finger. I forget the names now. The Americans used to call them Betty Grable and Gangbusters. They used to name after film stars, but we called it Mile End. Sausage Green Finger, I can remember, and the Chinese was at the front and the both sides. And when the Duke of Wellington was on there in the May, I went on R&R to Tokyo. You had to do a year in Korea to get 5 days leave. I used to go to Incheon, but if he was up the forward positions a lot, like I had been, because I was driving, they splashed a bit more money out and sent you to Tokyo. Ibisu Rest Camp, Tokyo. I did 5 days there, heaven. That was sheets on the bed and sauce on the table, it was heaven. Throw your dirty old clothing away, sailing, everything. When I came back, that was the 20th of May I went there. I know that well because it's my wife's birthday. When I came back, I came back on the 27th, I think. I was back in the line again. No, it must have been the 25th because the 26th, 7th and 8th, the Duke of Wellington had been under attack and lost a lot of men because the Chinese had come up through tunnels, so we heard, and cut them off at the back. So the fusiliers were going in, and you might know this, but this is, you may know the truth of this, I don't, but we was told it was the first time in Korea ever that a regiment was going to relieve another regiment in daylight. All relieving of regiments was done at night. And it was 11 o'clock, 10 minutes to 11, on the morning, I think, of the 28th of May, that we took over from the Duke of Wellington. There was bodies everywhere, Chinese everywhere. There was, they were like Mongolians. There were big 6 foot tall people and all dead, you know, laying everywhere. We drove up onto this hill and took over the hook. And from then on, life was hell. It was nothing but mortaring, and you couldn't get your head up. Everywhere you went, you was fired at, and that was the worst position. I thought myself, I'm not going to last up here. And I had a friend, Corporal Darby, who Terry was just telling me about, taken corporal. I've been with him from the day I joined, and we've been pretty close friends. And he's taken Lance Corporal. They said, if you want to be a Lance Corporal, sign on for an extra year. But you must be a regular, we'll make you up. Well, he fell for it. But I wasn't going to have that. So he said he'll do it. So I never see him no more for a long while. And I took they used to make me drive a truck now and again when the CO didn't use his jeep. They still employed me. Take the truck, you had him patrol out to the forward dropping off area. Where Corporal Darby was taking a patrol out, he was in charge of him. And he said to me, I haven't seen you for a long while. I said, oh, you haven't got long to do now, have you? I said, no, not long, but I said, I don't think I'm going to get through this. I don't think I'll survive this war. I just get that feeling. And it's in reverse of what you hear. He said to me, do you know what? You do get a feeling whether you survive or not. And I know I'm going to survive. He said, I know I'm going to get through this. I've got no worries at all. I said, Ed, I said, I don't think I'm going to get through this. I'm sure I'm not. Well, he was killed on the 27th of Armistice Day. He was killed on the very day of the armistice. Friendly fire. Shot by our own side, coming back off the patrol. He never gave a password. Yeah. So, next thing, it was my turn. 12th of June, 10 past 5 in the morning. Met Colonel Stevens. Lovely day, summer's day, nothing to be afraid of. Driving along the road. Got up to the forward company called the Jeep Head, they used to call it. Got up to the Jeep Head, and you was in kind of, no, not no man's land, but on the way to the forward company. We're in quite open country, with all the hills around, and suddenly mortaring started, really mortaring. I tell you what, dirt was hitting me in my neck, and he was crouching down, and I kept going, and I kept revving up the engine, because I tend to panic, even now when I'm driving, if it's a panicky situation, I tend to rev up, press the clutch in and rev. I don't know what does that, but he sensed the danger, I think. He stopped, he said stop. He jumped out of the Jeep and he crouching under mortar fire, he ran. And he said, get the Jeep under cover. Well, that was his last words for me. There was no cover. So I was just on the point of doing a kind of a 3-point turn to go back the way I'd come looking for cover when the next thing, well, I don't remember anything else. I was never unconscious, but the next thing happened, there wasn't a bang. All I see was a flash of light. It was like a blinding, a flash of lightning. That's how bright it was. And it appears the Jeep took a direct hit. But as I was sitting here, it hit the side of the step that you would step into the Jeep. And I was blown some 30 yards through the air, out past the passenger side. Went flying through the air and I landed, and I got it through both legs. And in my spine, in the back. I had a bulletproof vest on, which was obligatory, really, as a CO driver, because we never wore them in those days. We had to sign for them when we went on patrol, so I never had enough to go around. But as a CO driver, I had a personal weapon, gadget, a bulletproof vest, and a 120 signal set in the back of the Jeep that I was trained on. A Alpha, B Bravo, C Charlie, I was trained phonetically, so I know that even now. He was Sunray, he was always known as. So when they called up Sunray, I used to have this. But I had quite a good time sometimes listening to the patrols on it, engaging the abbots in the valley and all coded stuff, So I like radio. Anyway, I went flying through the air, couldn't breathe. I knew I was hitting the back somewhere, I just could not breathe. I was laying there and I thought that was it, finished. And through the haze, I could hear the shells going over, like it was like an express train going by me. What it happened to be was that was a tank that was stationed statically on a hill, was up returning fire, and their rounds were going over me at about 20 foot, I suppose. It was like an express train, that frightened me the most. And the next thing I had someone bending over me, working on me, and that turned out to be Corporal McMichaels, I think his name was. I was taken to the first aid post, and Captain Scott, the first thing he asked me, he was cutting all my clothing off, are you National Service? I said, yeah, and he was tooting, So I thought, well, I don't like National Service, getting out. And I was in a haze, I can't really remember a lot about that, injections and things. And then the next thing I remembered was airlifted in an helicopter to MASH. but not an American rash, because I was strapping me down on a table. I was all in green gowns and masks, but I was speaking the phone, and they turned out to be Norwegian mesh. Norwegian mesh. And they was the nearest mesh to our position, yeah? I spent a day, I woke up, that happened at 5:30 in the morning. I woke up at 3:30 in the afternoon. And I can remember as plain as anything now, I had a biscuit tin that beside me where I kept being sick into, vomiting into a biscuit tin. Because the last thing I remember was this big black rubber mask on my face, no nice injections. And I kept being sick and reaching all night long. And then the colonel came round, he was a colonel of the, a Norwegian colonel. And he said, oh no, we had a funny incident, everyone laughs about this, and even they laughed about it, but it was things that crop up can be really a bit of humour in a bad situation. A padre called Lorenz Pedersen, he was a padre for the mesh, and he came round with his Bible and his sash, and he said to me, would you like to be confirmed? Well, we was Church of England, so we went to funerals and weddings and christenings, so I don't know anything about religion. And I'm sensing he meant the last rites. What did I say? And they said I was a card, they all loved me. No thanks, I feel a bit better now, because I thought it was the last rites. And I thought, by telling him I wasn't that bad, I wouldn't die, and that was how silly it can be in a situation like that. And I actually said that, I feel a bit better now, I don't want to be young, you know. And I was really, not dying, but terribly ill, and that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. The mesh came round and said, oh, you're going to a lovely trip, you're going to Tokyo Military Hospital, which was an American hospital. We had one in Kure, but we never had one in Tokyo, I don't think. It was an American military hospital in Tokyo, our one was in Kure, which was a long way from Tokyo. Yeah? I spent, oh no, first of all, to say, the next night I went to Seoul. And I had a bed space by the Parliament building. I looked out and there in front was, it looked like St Paul's, which gave me a lot of comfort. If you've seen the Parliament building in Seoul, it's got a black dome the same size, not the same size as St Paul's, but a miniature one. And I used to lay in this bed in a haze, and they kept trying to make me drinks, orange juice and stuff, you know, and I had a terrible temperature. And I had no pain whatsoever, no pain at all. It was just like my legs had been cut off, you know. And I was looking at this Parliament building and thinking of St Paul's, because from Bethnal Green, where my mum lived, in his flat, so I could see St Paul's lit up in the night in my bedroom. It was really comforting, you know. Anyway, that evening we had a raid, an air raid. Used to have this, I've met a nurse recently that said this MiG used to come over every time at tea time. And the MiG came over, buzzed the city, so we all got moved on a while, down to the basement of the hospital. And when the all clear went up, we went again. And I remember thinking, I've gone all through this and you'll get killed in the bombing, like in the Blitz, you know, maybe unlucky, you know. I was saying all bad thoughts, really. Next thing was an Royal Australian Air Force Dakota, I think it was a DC-3, aren't they? All silver, with stretchers, and I was airlifted to Tokyo. My pain was beginning to come back because I think the morphine that they give you was wearing off. And I remembered, I was right by a square window like this, laying on the stretcher, and it was roaring down the runway. It was the first time I'd ever been on an airplane. And I actually thought, you know what, it wouldn't be a bad thing if it just crashed now, didn't take off. It would be like a welcoming. It was a feeling I can't describe, a welcoming relief for the plane to have crashed. You know, not because I was in pain, but the situation I was in. That's how I really felt, you know. I would give up. I just thought it would be better now if that's what happened. And I was going to Tokyo. I had an operation to remove the shrapnel that they couldn't get out of my back. I had that removed. Very big operation that was. I had an operation for a skin graft because the bulletproof vest, when the Americans wanted my vest back, because what they said was, the impact of the, what they told me was that if I'd have been 60 yards away, I'd been killed. But the nearer you are to a mortar bomb explosion, the more chance you have of surviving it, which could have fooled me, but I don't think I'd like to try that. But the impact of the metal that went into my back took they were, in those days, I don't know what they make them now, but they were nylon plates, all in padding, and it took the plate into my back. So I had to have several skin grafts taken off the cheeks of me behind and put onto my back. and that took a lot of preparation. So I was in the whole of that year, the summer, just getting better. Very nice. Oh, then they transferred me. They said, you've got to go to Britain to run your back, the Brits want you back. So they took me down to Curie, the British Britcom, it was called Britcom BMH Curie, the FBO 25. Never forget it, letters I wrote to my mum on their notepaper. And I had some couple of operations there. And I always remember, which really surprised me, is that if you, I always say to my wife now, if you knock yourself and it's painful, it's great. If you don't feel it, you're in trouble, because I never had much pain. But you know, I woke up from an operation and I was in agony. I was moaning all night long. And you couldn't stop yourself from moaning. And you know, he came in and said, you're on the mend. And it was the worst thing I've ever felt. I realise now, if you feel pain, it's not so bad, you know. And then I had recuperation. I went to a lovely island called Miyajima, which was off of the coast of Curie somewhere. And I was in a room with another chap from Hull, and he'd been a bit of shrapnel taking his scalp right off. He'd been scalped, you know, and we've got a nice friendship developed there. They looked after us, and we lived like lords. They give us pocket money and cigarettes, and everything was free, and Australian Red Cross used to bring cream cakes, and it was lovely, you know, and sunshine, and sitting there. I couldn't walk because of my legs, and Matron used to keep shouting at me because I kept having a stick. She said, you're not going to have that stick, try to stick away, and I said, couldn't walk. I was like Douglas Bardi in some ways, and I had legs. And I gradually recovered, and that took right up until November. I came home on a hospital ship called the Devonshire. It wasn't really a hospital ship, it was a troop ship. I came around in the hospital section. And I thought, thank goodness that's all over. And would you believe, I woke up one morning, I nursed by this time. I must tell you this, I had a stress disorder over this. But I never knew I had. I get a pension now for a stress disorder plus my wounds, because I don't use the lifts and things. But I never knew I had a stress disorder. And when it was going to Miyajima, we was all on this small boat. And we had two nurses accompanying us. And we all stood up to get off, and I suddenly felt ill. I had a panic attack, which you call panic attacks now. And I felt hot, faint, sickly, heart thumping. I thought I was going to die. I was just going to tell the nurse, and everyone rose to get off the boat. And from that day to 1989, I never told anybody how I felt. And in 1989, I went to be reviewed for my war pension, like they review you every so often. And it was on the 7th floor, and the lift man said, it's a restricted building, you can't walk up the stairs. Tomorrow I can get in a lift. And the doctor said, is that because of poo? I said, yeah. He said, why didn't you tell us long ago? So they pensioned me with stress disorder from 89. And that's how it all came about. But I came home to Millbank Hospital by the Tate Gallery, which was in those days with the military hospital. Spent some time in there, but they said I could go home the night, but you had to wear like blue pyjamas and a red tie. And there's no way I was going to walk down Bethnal Green like that with all the yobos about, you know. And you said, call out after and things, you know, just in fun in those days. Now it'd be different. So I stayed in. I was demobbed in, if I say March, but I think it might have been earlier now. It was after Christmas anyway. I should have been out on December the 6th. I didn't come out till about February. And then I sat in front of the medical officer in Millbank, and I was never one to put myself forward, but I never felt right. I was just a bundle of nerves. I knew I was nervous. I was nervous when I